Welcome to the President's Inbox, a CFR podcast about the foreign policy challenges facing the United States. I'm Jim Lindsay, Director of Studies at the Council on Foreign Relations. This week's topic is COVID-19 in Africa. With me to discuss how the coronavirus pandemic is affecting Africa is Michelle Gavin. Michelle is Senior Fellow for Africa Studies at CFR. She was previously the Managing Director of the Africa Center, and from 2011 to 2014, she was the U.S. Ambassador to Botswana, where she served concurrently as the U.S. Representative to the Southern African Development Community. Michelle, thanks for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
I want to note for our listeners that Michelle and I are practicing physical distancing, and we are recording this episode from our respective homes, so we apologize for any audio issues that might crop up, or if any of our family members make an unscheduled guest appearance. Michelle, I want to talk broadly about Africa. It's a large continent, more than 54 countries, so we're not going to be able to drill down to each and every one. Right. But perhaps you could just sort of set us up by giving us a broad overview of how the pandemic is being felt on the continent.
Absolutely. So 52 of Africa's 54 countries have recorded at least a case of COVID-19. Right now, the numbers are coming in at something like 14,000 cases, about 800 deaths. Testing is not widespread, so these numbers obviously are not telling the whole story, but it is widely spread throughout the continent, where in most cases, you are dealing with pretty weak health infrastructure. Of course, the situation is going to vary from place to place. It's a very different story in South Africa than the Central African Republic. But it is possible to generalize about overall access to ICU beds is very minimal. Many African communities have limited access to sanitation. In cities, there are often tremendously crowded conditions. Medical personnel are usually scarce. And you have a situation where the informal economy is a hugely important part of people's survival, perhaps as much as 89% of total employment. So when you think about things like shelter-in-place types of orders, it's not really feasible for most people who only eat if they earn money that day. So it's a really challenging context in a lot of ways. That said, Africa has a few things going for it in trying to fight this disease. It's incredibly youthful demographics, right? As we know, older people are more vulnerable to this virus becoming a very serious condition. Africa is tremendously young. It's less connected to the rest of the world, which is one reason why COVID-19 is coming to Africa after it hit so hard in Europe and certainly here in the United States. And it's possible that climate conditions could have an impact on the virus's spread, and that could work in Africa's favor.
I take your point about the differences in demographics, just to put some numbers on that. I was reading that in a country like Angola, the median age is about 16 years of age.
Right.
So about half the population is over the age of 16, half under the age of 16. To put that in perspective, in the United States and China, the median age is 38. So there is this real potential that if in fact the disease is not as severe on average among younger people, that will be to the benefit of Africa. But as you point out, African countries pretty consistently, I think, have healthcare infrastructures that are much more fragile than what you see in the United States or even a country like China, and their ability to mobilize resources to meet a surge in terms of the demands this disease would put on are pretty limited. So given where Africa is, and I think you noted that cases started showing up in Africa after it showed up elsewhere in the world, in some sense giving countries a little bit of a head start in order, in essence, they've seen what their future could be like. Could you take us to a couple specific countries and talk a bit about what steps they are taking, given the things you've already pointed out, having a weak health system, the recognition that many of their cities are densely populated, people work in the informal economy and don't have the option, like we have, to sort of stay at home and conduct their business electronically or digitally?
Sure. Well, it's been a fascinating exercise kind of in trying to learn from the rest of the world and get out ahead of the problem. So with a very small number of cases reported, you've had countries issue states of emergency, require lockdowns of major areas, or even countrywide lockdown orders, although of course how those are implemented, there's always more texture than meets the eye. And other places trying other methods, like Kenya decided to enforce a curfew, which comes with a lot of its own problems, but in an attempt to find a way to minimize the spread without keeping everybody at home all day, which is sort of fundamentally problematic from a survival point of view. So you've seen a number of countries very aggressively and very early, compared certainly to our own experience in the United States, go out there with big and costly policy steps to try and prevent the problem from getting out of control. You do have other cases of leaders with a different point of view. President Magufuli in Tanzania continues to encourage people to attend mass prayer services and is telling his citizens that they'll be protected in prayer. So it's a range. The other thing that the Africans have been doing is getting organized around the economic fallout of the crisis. As they've watched the situation in Europe and the United States, they are keenly aware of how fragile African economies are, and they're already feeling the pinch as demand for their exports evaporates. Take, for example, the cut flower sector in Kenya, 70,000 jobs. None of those people are working right now. None of those exports are leaving the country.
So Kenyans grow flowers and sell them presumably to the Middle East and Europe?
That's right. And it's an important sector for them. Tourism is another hugely important sector for them and for many others. There is no tourism happening right now, right? And they're also seeing a really dramatic decline in remittance, which are a huge part of a lot of African economies, certainly like the Somali economy.
Can you talk a little bit about that? Where are the remittances coming from?
Sure. So some economies really do depend on these payments coming from the diaspora. And, you know, African diasporas are spread far and wide. You find them in Europe, in the Middle East, in Asia, and in Australia. And as diaspora have been dealing with the same thing that everyone else in their community is dealing with, they're not earning money and they're not able to send it home. So there's already a dramatic sense of economic squeeze. And you're dealing with governments that have a lot less sort of fiscal space in which to operate and try and mitigate the problem. So there is an effort to get international attention to the issue, to try and get some relief from the debt burden that an awful lot of African countries are coping with, and increasingly now to try and raise a red flag around food security, which is going to be a huge problem, already is a huge problem in some parts of the continent, I think particularly of the Horn in East Africa, where just months ago, we were reading about the locust invasion, right? That was these biblical pictures and
billions of locusts.
Exactly, doing tremendous damage to agricultural production. Well, now on top of that, you have COVID-19, and these are places where food security can be very fragile anyway. So there is a real concern about famine.
Let's unpack that, because there's a lot there. And maybe we could begin with, to what extent are African countries coordinating their responses versus it's every country for itself?
I have been tremendously impressed with the coordination that's taking place thus far. And you've really seen the African Union playing an important role. The chairman of the AU right now is Cyril Ramaphosa of South Africa. He has really been asserting some leadership, pulling African heads of state together, making sure everyone's dealing with the same set of facts, but also sending some powerful messages around the need for economic relief to the international financial institutions. And just over the weekend, he appointed four extraordinarily prominent people to sort of act as envoys to the international financial institutions, to major donors, to the global economy on Africa's behalf, to try and get people's attention focused on the issue. You've had finance ministers coming together to deliver very clear messages. The Economic Commission for Africa has helped to do that as well. And there's, you know, been a request for about $100 billion relief package, in addition to at least kind of moratorium on debt payments. But everyone recognizes that's going to have to move to some type of write-off.
Well, let's talk about that debt problem, because it seems, as you described it, that African countries are really getting squeezed. On the one hand, they're required, under the terms of the debt they've taken out, whether it's bilateral debt, multilateral debt, or debt on commercial terms, to pay that money back. But what we're seeing is that the pandemic itself is sort of reducing revenue flows for these countries. And it's creating much more broadly, I think, the beginnings of certainly a global recession, if not a depression, which is going to squeeze those countries even further. Now, note the countries that have gotten most attention are probably the oil-producing countries, thinking like Angola, Nigeria, which has, because of a price war between the Saudis and the Russians, which may or may not be over, drove the price of oil down. And oil-producing countries in Africa depend heavily on oil revenue to finance their government activities. So low oil prices are a bad sign. So there's been this talk about debt relief. And I know that the G20 finance ministers is having a virtual meeting this week to discuss the issue of debt relief. Do you see any progress being made on that front?
It's incredibly likely that everyone will be able to agree to sort of a moratorium.
What would that mean? What does a moratorium mean in this context?
Essentially, that no one needs to pay to service their debt for a set period of time. Yep. That is not going to be enough to address the problem. But I think that's sort of where the consensus maybe is outside of the continent right now. But I think that the goalposts will have to shift pretty quickly.
Is it your sense that, at least on the multilateral front, that multilateral organizations are going to be sufficiently capitalized to be able to meet the demand? Because we're talking here about the challenges that African countries are facing. But I'll note, I believe the Turks have already gone to the IMF. I think Iran is doing something similar. I mean, I would expect a lot of countries to want to be lining up, at least on the multilateral front, asking for help to get them through these perilous times.
Yeah, my sense is that it's demands unlike the financial institutions have seen before. And so Africa is going to be competing in a crowded field, right? But there are only so many other places to turn, and there's just really limited sort of reserves on the continent to deal with this. So there's the immediate expenditure needs that every country hit by COVID is experiencing. And there's, you know, they don't have sufficient resources domestically in any of these countries, right, to just deal with that. And then there's the economic fallout. And you had the World Bank coming out on, I think it was Friday, suggesting that Africa is absolutely headed for its first recession in 25 years. McKinsey has estimated that something like between 3 and 8% of GDP will be lost. And, you know, breaking that out a little bit, it's looking like at a minimum, right, 50 million more Africans tipped into extreme poverty. So the ramifications of a downturn on that scale, even for stability, are substantial. And I don't see how the international community can sort of ignore the scope of the problem.
I want to come back in a moment to the response by the international community. If I may, Michelle, I want to pick up on your point about the potential consequences of COVID-19, the pandemic, for stability in Africa. Mm-hmm. And I will note, going outside the region, people have speculated about what COVID-19 will mean for the ruling regime in Iran. Might North Korea have a big COVID-19 problem that could see the unseating of Chairman Kim? As you look across the continent, I realize you're talking more than four dozen countries, are there particular countries you look at, you say you're worried that this could just be one other challenge that is going to, in essence, in combination with the others, lead to massive political upheaval, change, repression, what have you?
Yes, I am very worried for Sudan, which is in the middle of a fragile transition anyway, with a very delicate balance between military and civilian authorities that are supposed to be working in concert, driving the country toward a place where there can be a legitimate election. And what we see is around the world is that COVID and the need to respond to kind of an unprecedented crisis leads to a shrinking of democratic space, right? And a sort of justification for authoritarian action. So I'm incredibly worried that the balance tips in favor of the military there in a way that it's going to be very hard to unravel, and that they lose important time in trying to execute on some of the reforms that are necessary to have any shot at building the kind of new Sudan that the popular movement ousted the old regime had in mind. So I'm worried there. I'm worried about Ethiopia, where there had been elections scheduled for this year in August. Those elections have now been postponed because of a state of emergency. It was already a volatile situation leading into those elections. But in the absence of clarity about when elections will occur and under what circumstances, people who had been feeling disenfranchised, frustrated, are suspicious. They see this, right, as just one more reason why their voice won't be heard. And there is already violence there, and there certainly could be more. So I think that in the Horn in particular, there are reasons to be very concerned.
Back to the issue of the international community's response. I'm curious how you assess China's role in the continent and what it's likely to do. And I ask because you're well aware there's been a lot of writing, some of it positive, much of it quite negative about China's role in Africa, the willingness of the Chinese government to extend loans and underwrite investments in infrastructure and the economy and like that. Because China has been playing such a prominent role in terms of providing funds, a lot of governments in Africa owe money. So the question then becomes one, will the Chinese join with other countries in accepting, I guess what they would call in the business, a haircut on their loans? I've heard some speculation that the Chinese government so far is not inclined to want to cut its borrowers better deals. Indeed, that many of the Chinese loans weren't on the traditional soft terms that governments do bilaterally or multilaterally, but they were on commercial terms and that the Chinese expect to get paid. I've heard other people say, no, the Chinese are going to step to the plate because they see taking steps to alleviate the debt load as really smart soft power that will buy them goodwill and further entrench China's interests in the calculations of African leaders. How do you read the whole situation with China's activity and what it may be doing or may not be doing?
Sure. Well, I think China's been incredibly assertive in trying to seize on this moment to cast itself in a leadership role in Africa, where China is at the forefront of the global community that is attentive to African needs and coming to Africa's aid. And until this weekend, they'd been pretty effective at that, I would say, with a lot of coordinated messaging from their diplomats on the ground and from Beijing about the assistance they're willing to provide, you know, able to kind of lump in both private companies, philanthropists, and the state all in one well-messaged package. But you're right. I think one of the challenges they're going to experience is really around the debt issue. Africa's got about $145 billion in debt to China. Do they expect to see that money? Put me in the camp that says, I don't think so. Do they want the influence that those relationships imply? Absolutely. So there's not going to be just forgiveness and good luck to you. And one of the interesting things around the terms of a lot of these loans is that they're not public. So I see kind of a revision, perhaps some grace periods, et cetera, but it's not always going to be clear what the hook still is. It helps China feel confident it still has influence and leverage over these governments, because I think that's really what it's about for them. It's about making sure that in multilateral fora and on issues important to them, everything from tech standards to votes at the UN, that they can kind of call in these chits, and they're not going to give that up.
Looking at other parts of the international community that have historically been big donors, what about Europe? Is Europe stepping up to the plate, or is it the case that Europe is so consumed with the challenges within the European Union that it's lost sight of what's happening in Africa, particularly given that several European countries have longstanding ties dating back to the colonial era in Africa?
Sure. Well, I think that Europe has been trying, certainly I think more effectively than the United States, to message that they're aware of the seriousness of the threat to Africa and trying to organize themselves to respond. And the French are really at the forefront of that. The EU has, you know, tried to pull together a package, but the message becomes a bit muddled from them because, as so often, there are so many priorities that it looks like nothing's a priority. But the French president is trying to assert some leadership here, trying to ensure that the G20 kind of make good on their commitments and that things go further. I think, though, there are real limits to what France can do unilaterally. And while they have made some commitments to assistance, when you get those spread out across sort of 19 countries that are typically recipients of French aid, it's not sufficient in and of itself to look game-changing.
You made a brief aside to U.S. position on these issues. I take it you're disappointed in the reaction of the U.S. government. Maybe you could tell me a little bit more about what the U.S. government is doing, talking about doing, might do, should be doing.
Well, I think that away from the headlines, the U.S. government does a lot of good things. I mean, the sheer amount of investment the U.S. has made over the years in health system strengthening broadly, largely as a function of our investment in fighting HIV/AIDS. But there was been a recognition for many years going back.
Could I get you just to spell that out a little bit? Because I'm not sure most Americans understand the kind of financial and intellectual commitment the U.S. government has made over the last 12, 15 years on these issues.
So ever since President George W. Bush announced the President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief, or PEPFAR, the U.S. government has been sort of exponentially more important than any other donor in the world in terms of the resources devoted to fighting HIV. So take a country like Botswana, big HIV problem, but fairly small population. We've invested billions in fighting this disease in that one country alone. And this has been replicated across the continent. And just to be clear, Botswana spends even more of their own money on fighting it than the U.S. does. But one of the things the U.S. has recognized in trying to fight a single disease is that it's almost impossible to do without strengthening overall health system infrastructure. And so that is something that the U.S. has been doing for a long time that is unquestionably wildly helpful to Africa right now. And it's something that I see our diplomats on the ground trying to talk about, trying to point out that the U.S. has been there for a long time, that we're not going to go away. That said, you know, the messages from the very top of our administration, you don't hear President Trump talk about global leadership in helping the rest of the world cope with this crisis or in thinking about how the global economy is going to recover, right? The messages we hear are very domestically focused, and then sometimes they're outright unhelpful on the continent. So when our president decided to attack the WHO, Republicans in Congress too have been raising questions about WHO leadership. One of the things that's been a consequence of that is a tremendous amount of anger in Africa, where you see African heads of state rising to defend Dr. Tedros, the director general of the WHO, who happens to be an Ethiopian, very well respected. It's seen as an attack on African competence, on multilateral institutions that give voice to African equities. And it's difficult. I don't think I can overstate how damaging it is. I don't think it was done in any way with the intention to send any message in Africa, but we seem surprisingly unaware of the consequences sometimes of some of the messaging coming from the top. The last thing I would say on this is just that Africans are utterly shocked at the shambolic domestic response in the U.S. They can't believe it. If you know, sort of follow the conversation in their op-ed pages or social media, people are stunned that a country as rich as the United States, a country that played such an important leadership role in responding to the West African Ebola outbreak, right, could be so far behind on testing, could possibly be such a kind of disorganized mess. And that absolutely diminishes the standing of the United States.
Well, I'll note that I think many Americans are surprised that we've had the kind of response to the pandemic that we've had. I want to ask you a question about one other group we haven't talked about, and that is the sort of philanthropic community. There are a large number of philanthropies designed to provide aid to Africa, to work with Africans across a whole array of issues. How are they responding to the challenge? I mean, I would imagine, you know, if you are a charity who's done a lot of work in Africa, you may not be the first group that Americans right now are thinking about in terms of giving, you know, your charitable dollars. Indeed, for a lot of Americans, losing their job, worried about losing their job, obviously charitable contributions get pushed down the list. So what has happened to that part of the response? And do we see some early signs that may be positive, early signs that you think are troubling?
It's a great question. It's a question I've been asking myself. Where's the center of gravity for that community? Certainly a number of organizations that do great work on the ground have been trying to sort of send up flares about the potential scope of the health challenge and the almost certain economic fallout from what's going on around the world. There are philanthropists, very prominent ones in the U.S., who've devoted tremendous resources, right, to Health Africa. What I'm seeing from them is a little bit of a stand back and trying to assess, okay, where is intervention most needed? Who's doing what? There is a sense of kind of what's the plan, right? So as much as we might be asking ourselves domestically sometimes, what's the plan for the way forward? I think the global plan is equally undetermined, and that makes it hard for actors to know how to plug in. And it's really telling when you compare it with China, right? Where you have Jack Ma and Alibaba Foundation playing this incredibly prominent role poll. They're in the paper all the time. They're on every news clip. It's unavoidable to see that response. And you don't have that right now with the Gates Foundation. You have very thoughtful commentary. And I'm not suggesting that they're sitting on their hands. It's a very different style of philanthropy. There's a different desire for credit, and there's a different degree of coordination, right, with the state. And so I think it's a very good question. I think it will take shape going forward, but it's not at all clear what role these organizations will be playing.
Just on that question, I'm sort of thinking down the road. There's a lot of talk about the potential to create a vaccine. And I've heard some virologists say that we might be able to do it in as soon as 18 months. I don't know whether 18 months is realistic. I know there are plenty of diseases for which scientists have been struggling for a long time to come up with vaccines and haven't yet succeeded. But if we were to take the optimistic view, Michelle, that a vaccine does come, whether it's 18 months, 2 years down the road, has anyone been giving thought to how you make sure poorer countries, and I think this would be true, or poorer populations within countries would get access to such vaccines? I mean, you talked about PEPFAR and the work done there. That was a fairly substantial investment by the United States, as you point out. Any preliminary thoughts about how you might make sure that everybody gets access to a vaccine that's going to be in very high demand, certainly at the start?
Right. Well, certainly I've seen conversations trying to get everyone to buy into the consensus that the vaccine should be available to everyone, regardless of their ability to pay. And, you know, Africa's good at vaccination, really good. It is the case that some infectious diseases for which we have vaccines are still problems in parts of the continent. But it's also the case that individual Africans all across that continent go to tremendous lengths to get access to vaccines. And they know how to do it. The distribution channels, even in very difficult spaces, are there. So I think the real question is going to be around equity, right? Ensuring that this is not safety for the rich. And that's going to play out on domestic and international levels, unquestionably. The last thing I would say on this is that, you know, African scientists have played an incredibly important role in things like the Ebola vaccine that has been developed and has some real efficacy, and have a lot to offer in terms of thinking about infection control in under-resourced settings, right? From because of the outbreaks that they've experienced in West and Central Africa of other highly infectious viruses. So there's a really important technical role that African scientists and healthcare workers and public health officials can play. And it's going to be, if we can get organized around a global response, Africa's got a lot to offer, not just sitting there waiting to be a recipient.
I want to ask one last question, Michelle, and I want to tap your expertise, given that you were an ambassador in Africa, as I mentioned, in Botswana. In a moment like this, what is it that a U.S. ambassador is or should be doing in the host country?
Well, issue one, and you see this play out, right, is ensuring the safety of your people. So thinking about everyone who works for your mission and their families, and then all the U.S. citizens, right, if they want to go home, are you helping them get their way home? And this has clearly consumed a tremendous amount of the attention of our teams on the ground, many of which are thinly staffed anyway. So your sort of first duty, right, is to get everybody safe to look out for American citizens. After that, I think there's an incredibly important role to play, not just in sort of talking up what the U.S. has done and the assistance that the U.S. continues to provide, but really being that kind of effective transmitter of the key messages back and forth so that our teams on the ground are providing the type of information required for people to make smart decisions about how the U.S. should lead and should respond. So, you know, all the contacts that people have on the ground, tapping those contacts, understanding what's needed and how we can constructively work with these partners going forward. It's got to be an incredibly busy time for our missions. And, you know, one just hopes that at the other end in Washington, there is the bandwidth in such a difficult time and the will to take this on board and to understand how the United States might help to create a post-COVID world that we want to live in.
On that note, I'm going to close up the President's Inbox for this week. My guest has been Michelle Gavin, Senior Fellow for Africa Studies here at the Council on Foreign Relations. Michelle, I want to thank you for joining me, especially since we had some technical difficulties trying to get this show recorded. But again, I really appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. It's my pleasure.
Please subscribe to The Presence Inbox on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, wherever you listen, and leave us a review. They help us get noticed and improve the show. As always, opinions expressed in The Presence Inbox are solely those of the host or our guests, none of CFR, which takes no institutional positions on matters of policy. Today's episode was produced by Zoe Collis with senior producer Jeremy Sherlock. Zoe also did double duty as a recording engineer. Thank you, Zoe. Special thanks to Margaret Gatch for her assistance. This is Jim Lindzay. Thanks for listening.